Hi, before we get started on today's show, I wanted to share with you an opportunity to get face-to-face with a number of the most popular Run-As guests, including Jeffrey Snover, Mark Manassi, and Paul Thurrott at the IT Edge Intersection Conference, October 25th to 28th at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. At the conference, you'll get to see folks like Mark Manassi, who will be doing his usual amazing job of helping you understand what Microsoft is up to with his new session on Server 2016, talking about what's awesome, what's irritating, what's improved, and what's expensive. Mark's been writing Mastering Windows Servers books now for over 20 years, and he's got some great advice that can help you get put to work immediately. Register today at itedgeintersection.com. We'll see you there.
From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 495, IPv6 Comes to the Cloud with guest Ed Horley. Recorded Tuesday, October 4th, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. This is another one of our cool Monday episodes brought to you by Atlassian's Jira Service Desk. I encourage you to check that out. My guest today is Ed Horley, now the Vice President of Engineering at Groupware Technology in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he's the author of the Practical IPv6 for Windows Administrators from APress book, and is the co-chair of the California IPv6 Task Force. And I got to tell you a story, Ed. I had a flood in my basement.
Uh-oh.
That's happened before, so I had to gut my office. And, you know, when you have an opportunity like that where you have to take everything out, I purged a lot of stuff, but I've got my Practical IPv6 book. I kept it. It made the cut.
It made the cut? that's nice. Yes. If you lost it, just let me know.
I did not lose it. It was on a shelf. It didn't even get wet, but where many books went into a box to be sent off to Salvation Army or something like that, that was the book that went, no, that needs to go back on the shelf. That's an important book.
Well, I appreciate that. and that's a shame that you flooded out like that. That's horrible.
Yeah, the drain line out of the house collapsed probably in the summer. And so we finally had a big enough rain. This is last November. So this is like pushing a year ago. And it put 2 inches of water across the whole basement. So
wow. Well, you had your servers up high enough, right?
18 inches off the floor, man. I do DR for my home, of course. There was virtually nothing on the floor, right?
That's when the ceiling opens up and the bathroom that's right above starts leaking on your servers, and then you...
You would not be incorrect, but I have a rubber membrane over the top of my server closet, too.
Oh, you've done everything. Thought of all use cases.
Remember, I helped build data centers in hurricane zones. I have thought through a lot of stuff. I was prepared.
That's awesome.
All the built-in cabinetry in the basement's on 2.5-inch kicks, so the cabinets didn't get wet. We just replaced the kicks.
Oh, there you go. Wow. You really have had to deal with this.
Oh, no, I think about these things. Yeah. I'm married to a woman whose reaction to the flood was to pull out the plans and say, so what rooms did you want to renovate? Which is why it's taken so long to get back together again, is that,
That's one of the ones. So how am I going to spend your money this week?
That's right. So we have a very nice new rec room, and she has a shiny new office, and my office is now built to do podcasting. So I have a proper broadcast arm. I have an on-the-air light that shines outside of my office when I'm doing my thing. So, yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. That's pretty cool.
It's been good fun, such as it is, for months and months of work. But here we are. Hey, we got to talk a little IPv6 because things are progressing.
Yeah, they are. Well, I mean, you were at Ignite, right? So you got the chance to hang out at Ignite. They had a pretty big announcement at Ignite around IPv6.
Let's talk about that for folks who weren't there.
Yeah, I mean, the announcement was, I mean, you know, formal announcement from the Azure team is now there's IPv6 for Azure VMs available in most regions. I'd actually say the majority of regions, because the list that they're not available is pretty short.
Yes.
There's only 5 that they're not available in out of all the regions for Azure. But yeah, pretty impressive. So they've got IPv6 deployed for Azure VMs. It's not going to be available for every single service offering across Azure, but if you can deploy a virtual machine, you can get a service running for V6 on your own. You don't even need them. And it's dual stacked. So it's IPv4 and IPv6 for virtual machines. So I'm really, really excited about this. It's for load balancers, virtual machines, and virtual network. And it's all set up and ready to go. And I've got to get some more complex lab set up in there to test out some crazy things I've been wanting to do on sort of public cloud with V6 for a while now.
And it sounds like this is just going to be turned on by default now. So, I mean, I feel like a lot of IPv6 addressable machines appeared on the network or are appearing on the internet now because of this.
Yeah. So I think this is a big milestone for a couple of reasons. Number one, they did beat Amazon to market on virtual machines for IPv6, which is, I imagine, for the Microsoft team is a feather in their cap.
Yep.
So I think they're happy about that. But more importantly, structurally, this certainly solves one of the constrained issues they have, which was just how many IPv4 addresses they were going to have to allocate for everything. For those that are interested in just dealing with mobile devices, every mobile operator in the U.S. has V6 enabled. You can pretty much stand up a V6 only service for mobile side and probably be fine and never even have to turn on a V4 service, which sounds a little strange. to say that statement out loud, but yeah, it's possible to do stuff like that now. So I think, this gives them a leg up in that area. I don't imagine that Amazon is very far behind, because they released their S3 service, their storage service, as IPv6 available. And so that means that the remaining portion of their services are probably going to be coming online for V6. I would imagine my guess is that at reInvent in November, we're going to see some other announcements coming out from them. That means the number one and number two cloud providers will have V6 done across the board.
And part of this has got to be their relationship to IANA and just like actually getting those addresses, getting the service providers that are coming into those data centers to actually route IPv6 in the first place.
That was part of it. I mean, there was actually some structural issues for Azure in regards to V6, and and maybe sometime you can get Albert Greenberg from the Azure team who owns Azure Networking on.
Every time I talk to you, I need to take notes. I take Albert Greenberg. I need that name.
And he could definitely talk to it from a stronger position. There's a handful of other folks on his team that actually did the IPv6 work. From a big picture perspective, they just needed to address. I mean, as with most things at cloud scale, it's all really software.
Right.
And the software issues that go around supporting V6. But there are some underlying hardware constraints that they were dealing with, I think mainly around multicast and multicast support and what needs to happen there. But, you know, when you choose to adopt just one service offering for something as fundamental as a protocol.
Yes.
There's a lot of things you have to go and touch. And that means there's a lot of software development that has to happen, because you have to go validate all of that stuff. And there's a lot of moving parts. So it doesn't surprise me that it took them, you know, this long to be able to get V6 support sort of done within even virtual machines. And I think that's going to be true for Amazon too. The fact that they've got S3 means that they've got the acceleration, and this was their first thing that they were sort of putting out there to make available. I anticipate the rest of the services will come shortly, because once you're able to validate one, it shouldn't be as painful to do the rest.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's complete speculation on my part. I don't know how hard it is for them to retrofit any of their software. So someone on the Amazon team is probably laughing at me going, "You have no idea, you fool."
Yes, but you have no idea what you just said, what it actually takes to do any of those things. But isn't that always the case one way or the other?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, Google has in the Google Cloud Platform side, they've got V6 there for virtual machines. It's actually GCE that is a little further behind for their product portfolio. But overall, I say the scorecard for V6 has been fantastic for this year. I mean, 2016 has been a banner year for IPv6. Without a doubt, it is high in terms of a great year for V6 overall.
Yeah, just I feel like we're making progress all around. In the consumer level, it's still basically non-existent.
Actually, on the consumer level, it's huge. The consumer side is actually where all the adoption is. It's
On the mobile, I'm thinking on home broadband.
Oh yeah, even home. If you got Comcast, it's turned on natively by default. So if you're using Comcast's, you know, CPE device and their Wi-Fi, you're V6 enabled automatically right out of the gate. You're running V6.
Nice. So it is very much from a provider-to-provider level.
Let's talk about the differences there. I mean, if you break it down, realistically, the home cable subscriber folks have the exact same problem that the mobile folks have,
right,
which is they just don't have enough addresses to hand out. They're getting V6 enabled because it's the only way to free up resources to allow them to continue offering and selling services. So they have the same structural problem. The people that don't have the problem are actually the enterprises. They've got enough V4 addresses that they just don't want to tackle this particular problem right now. Mobile providers have done it. Obviously, the cloud providers are doing it now. And if you look at the next stage of where things are going, I imagine those that are in the IoT space are really going to be the next major, you know, growth platform for IPv6. And I think the enterprise is going to continue to lag, and I don't foresee that changing anytime soon.
Because they have their IPs and they're NATing internally.
Yeah, they've got IPv4. It's functionally working. I've seen a couple disruptors for that. Mm-hmm. So, and I'll cover one of them really quickly. One of the disruptors is actually for folks that are, you know, dealing with partnering scenarios with certain companies that may or may not have enough V4 address space available. One side saying, we only have V4. The other side saying, I only have V6. you have to meet in the middle someplace. It's right. Far easier to add V6 than to try and go out and cobble together some V4 to solve that particular problem.
It's interesting.
Yeah. And that's the real world problem. I dealt with a very large enterprise just recently that was going through this growth problem, merger acquisitions, in addition partnering. And then finally with some folks that were traveling internationally and ended up being on networks that only had IPv6, they couldn't get back to their corporate office. They couldn't actually gain access to resources. It was a huge structural problem. And so a bunch of teams downstream got yelled at about the fact that their executives couldn't get online to access corporate resources.
One angry CIO and boom, we're supporting IPv6.
Yeah, yeah. But it never comes down to a discussion like that. And that's what the problem is for the enterprises around V6 adoption. But sure. For everyone else, you know, in the United States now, if you look at Google's global, you know, per country IPv6 adoption, you look at the United States, we're almost at 30%.
Wow.
And just short of 30% by a little bit.
Where are you going to go that you're getting only IPv6 addresses?
You're going to go to certain parts of the world that actually don't have as much allocation.
Right.
In some countries, it's going to be easier for certain people to be allocated V6. And then you're going to have certain mobile subscribers tethering off their handsets.
Right.
They're going to get V6 only in those particular markets.
Right. So that's, to me, sounds like developing countries that are grabbing the smartphone in a big way.
Yes. And so that's really where you're going to run into those particular issues. I don't know demographics for countries as well as I probably should because I'm so U.S. centric. My sure. apologies to your international listeners.
Dude, that's more than half, by the way.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. That doesn't surprise me. But I mean, the funny part is for the United States being up as high as 30%. I mean, I had someone walk up to me the other day. We were chatting about it casually and he's like, well, why should I pay attention to it? I go, I don't know. With 1/3 of the internet not interesting or what do you want me to say at that point?
Yeah, the next highest number I'm looking at the graph right now is Germany at 25%. Like these are big numbers. This is a big chunk of the internet.
You can, if you actually zoom in on, so if you hit Europe and you actually hit Europe and you actually look at, I think Belgium's at like some crazy number. I mean,
46.8. Yeah. Good Lord. Right. So it's not just the color green on this graph because they are also having reliability latency issues around it.
Right.
That's interesting.
You know, how crazy is that? That 46%, you know, almost 50% of Belgium is IPv6. I guess if you want to talk to Belgium, you better be talking IPv6
because right.
one half of the people are doing V6 for you.
That's where they're at.
I think that's the, even Greece is almost caught up to the US. It's 26.5.
Wow.
Look at that.
They have another set of issues.
But yeah. Other sets of issues, but you know, V6 is not one of them apparently. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say to people that sort of say, hey, where's V6 today? In the internal sort of scuttle with just sort of the technical task force and things like that, I was like, should we keep doing things like the California V6 task force? I mean, our job's sort of done, right?
Right.
You know, 1 out of 3 of adoption for V6 in the US, we're way past the, you know, early adopter phase.
Yeah.
We're way past the anything that would be considered early adoption around V6 is sort of done.
Yeah. Isn't the magic number like once you get to 10%, you're sort of there?
Right. And so we're way past 10% in the US footprint. So I sort of scratch my head and go, how long do we need to continue developing content and conferences and everything else? I think there's enough content out there to understand how to get V6 deployed. It's really just now, are there business drivers? Are there specific technology needs that you need for it? I do think there are technology needs that could really leverage V6. And mm-hmm. we've chatted a little bit about this in the past around things like containers and what goes on with containers is going to be really interesting, especially for V6.
Well, and this is the same thing on the IoT side. There's a bunch of technologies coming down the pipe that are becoming very important to businesses that are connectivity hungry, and they are point of contact hungry, and you just don't have enough IPv4 addresses to tackle these things. I'm looking at Docker swarm configurations where we're talking hundreds of containers. I'm kind of dreading that.
And I think the other part, besides the cloud container microservices architectures, which just dovetail incredibly well with V6 in terms of what you can do, the IoT side is really that sensor landscape side, right? Right. How many total sensors can you have? Mm-hmm. What sort of efficiencies can you have? I think that is interesting. And there are whole markets that people just don't think about that are doing this. And I think farming is a really interesting one.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really cool when you started digging into this. And Ed, give me one second here to pay the bills, because this episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by Atlassian, makers of the Jira Service Desk. Jira Service Desk is a new service management software that IT teams will love to use. Built on the Jira platform, Jira Service Desk helps you deliver cheerful service, is simple to set up, and so affordable that you won't even need your boss's approval. Try it free today and get a free t-shirt if you're one of the first 100 listeners to sign up at Atlassian.com/runasradio.
Free t-shirt. That's pretty awesome.
That's, yeah. And it's a specialty t-shirt, right? Like the Atlassian guys make a lot of cool stuff, but you know,
they do. I use Confluence every single day. So I love their products.
Yeah. And I think it made sense for them to sort of extend the Jira footprint into this other area. Like I love the idea that a tech support call can be turned into a work item for development. Like,
yeah, that's a big plus. That's a nice win.
When I think about DevOps style development, right, where we're really responsive to customer needs, it's these kinds of tools that make that possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I've been a fan for their stuff for a long, long time, and sort of under the radar sort of shop, but really remarkable work that they do and really great products.
Yeah, it turns out when you're busy getting things done, you don't have a lot of time to toot your horn, but I am happy to do the tooting for them.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I also see on the IPv6 side, this is where mobile made so much. Like the smartphone revolution all but broke the internet. When you think back to, you know, AT&T's utter crippling by the iPhone in 2007, 2008.
Well, and I guess it's still breaking the internet, right?
It is.
How many, what was it? All the cameras and sensors and other devices that brought Brian Krebs' site down. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I've been paying Brian because I'd love to do that show, but he's a busy, busy guy, but he handled himself very well. When Akamai's calling you, telling you, we got to take you down.
Uncle.
That's a heck of a phone call.
Yeah. And when he's reposting out, like, you know, I did the quick fix and posted out on DNS for that and set it to 127.0.0.1 on the IPv4 side. And I hopefully set ::1 for the V6 side. Redirect all the traffic to your local machine.
Yes.
I was like, wow, okay, that's the internet has failed today.
Yes. But, you know, and once again, this expansion of devices increases the attack surface, and IPv6 is not the whole cure, but it's a non-trivial piece of the cure.
Well, I guess it can be both, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be a cure and a problem at the same time. We get infinite more addresses to be able to hide behind or distribute content out from. But the good news is that you at least know who's hitting you.
Yes.
And I think that transparency is useful for, you know, for a bigger internet that's going through some big changes from a governance model, right? So
yep.
with IANA being out from underneath the foot of the United States, I guess we say it that way.
There's a bunch of interpretations on that particular statement, Mr. Harley.
But yeah.
But I'm with you as a Canadian. It's like, you know, this is part of maturing an infrastructure for the world.
Yes, absolutely. I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of what the Internet Society is doing, mm-hmm. what a lot of these other independent organizations who are really trying to make the internet better for the world overall. Big fan of the Deploy 360, big fan of a lot of the stuff that's happening in that space. And I think it's really important that I think the U.S. has actually been pretty good stewards.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Yeah.
And I think we've done a good job helping that way. I think it got a little weirdly political within the last few weeks here around a bunch of that.
I don't know if you know this, but you guys are weirdly political right now.
Oh, man, let's not even touch that
one. I'm just saying, I think there's a reason It is an interesting time.
We live in interesting times, so we can't be more blessed than that, right?
Yes. But I also think, you know, we are making some good choices there. And part of the challenge I have, and you and I think both battle this, is being old time computer folks, like we're just not aware enough of the rest of the world. And the more we can help our organizations that help shape the internet think beyond the Western world, much less the United States, the better the whole planet will be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's actually the Deploy 360 folks have a really great article up on their site talking about the deployments that they're doing in Africa around V6. And Africa is from a registrar standpoint, is the last one that has a large volume of IPv4. But even so, they chose to do all the work around getting V6 deployed because they realized that's the way going forward. And so if you're going to invest time, resources, and energy to go get something built, why are you going to start off with something legacy right out of the gate?
Yeah.
Go ahead and get the right stuff deployed there. And so this is all for, you know, IPv6 in Kenya and Zimbabwe and a couple other footprints. But it's pretty cool. I mean, it's remarkable from a sort of worldwide community standpoint how much work is going on, you know, overall. It's not just IPv6. I mean, you know, DNSSEC, DANE, everything else, the newer stuff to help secure the internet overall, which is really important. I think people sort of, you know, tend to forget that we have the, you know, fundamental protocols V4 and V6, but if you're not securing stuff on top of it, it's all for naught, right? And I think that's an important message too for many people if you're not paying attention to those particular things. And then secure BGP for secure routing. I think those are the sort of key tenets of understanding how your infrastructure actually works so that, you know, folks like Brian don't get hammered to death.
Well, and I don't know that it would stop the hammering, but at least we could catch the guys, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
If we've got better, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but IPv6 is eminently more traceable. DNSSEC means you're not getting hacked at that level. The SEC BGP is stopping routing from being manipulated again for that level. So, I mean, it's not that you could stop a DOS attack from happening, but at least you'd know where it was coming from, you know, who it was.
Right. And you'd have a much better insight into who the exploited boxes,
sure,
the M platforms that are actually exploited. And those can go into a, hey, you're not going to be able to notify everyone. But the reality is you can put people on sort of gray lists that sort of say, hey, you know, these look like bad actors or someone who's at least exploited.
Yes.
You can at least, you know, provide a resource for people to go look themselves up or for third parties to look themselves up and determine sort of how trustworthy you are, how clean a network you actually maintain.
Remember when blacklists for like SMTP relay worked?
Yeah, those don't work anymore.
They don't work anymore. They're dead. But in the early days of the internet, when we were first going public and this was a problem, you know, we had a fairly good community solution for you just letting you know, hey, you've got a problem here. You need to address it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I pine for the old days when we could just write a single host file and know explicitly every single person on the internet.
Yeah, pretty much.
This doesn't exist anymore.
No. And that's good news as well as it's complicated news. Like we've got to keep up with the times here that there's just so much more going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I have pure sideline interest here. I'm going to derail you on the V6 conversation here.
I'm not opposed.
What did you think was the most important announcement at Ignite?
Oh,
I'm of interest in this one, so I'm really interested in hearing what you...
Well, I'm hugely biased because of Humanitarian Toolbox, right? So the announcement of the public cloud for public good, and it's like here's your Azure credit and Office 365 and CRM. And again, I'm putting my hat on, like that directly benefits our efforts in that charity.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, does everyone on the show actually know what you're doing around that?
I hope so. We talk about it fairly often. And I, like most people, struggle tooting my own horn, but it's like, look,
I'm going to turn the tables on you. Toot your own horn now. So tell me about it.
We build open source software for disaster relief organizations. And that's what we started out as, which was really the mindset of it's really hard for developers to give development effort to charity and do right by the charity, because no software is truly free, right? Software is free the same way a puppy's free.
Right, absolutely.
And so the idea that we would have an organization that would manage that software so that developers can volunteer and come and go on the project was sort of the cornerstone of what we started with. And it, you know, things cascaded fairly well, and we're a 501c3 and so forth. But the other aspect of this is we pretty quickly figured out it's not enough just to build the software. We should operate it too. We're on a path I see as disaster response as a service.
How cool is that? So you're building the full, so it's building on top of Azure and building on top of that service offering for what they provide there. So
exactly.
Microsoft's committed in and saying, we're going to give you runtime and resource on Azure to be able to support your guys' software development efforts and actually hosting this
right.
for nonprofits.
So this, and this is where we ended up, right? It's like several years ago when we were first starting out on this, and I talked to the Azure team because I, you know, have that ability to, you know, had my engagements inside of Microsoft. I said, this is what we're doing. They basically said, how much Azure would you like? And this is before Microsoft was organized to do it. There was before Microsoft Philanthropy. So we've always had a great relationship. And what happened at Ignite was it clearly said, this is a good idea that we, you know, we want to use the public cloud for public good. And so, you know, I think we're one of the examples of, because we're essentially a charity born in the cloud. You know, that's what we are. And the fact that it makes more sense to run this software on the behalf of organizations like EnvoAd and the Red Cross and so forth, because they all have missions and none of those missions directly involve software. So the fact that we could take that software problem off the table, and, you know, the conversation I had with the Red Cross when we were building this app called Already was, you know, you don't actually want a web server, any of those things. What you want is all this stuff to just work. And they're like, yeah, I was like, we'll make it work. That's our job. We'll do that. So we, you know,
how cool is that?
I think we're sitting in a really coherent mission now. And enough so that Microsoft is saying, yeah, here you go. Here's a program for you that will make that work.
That's amazing, Richard. Congratulations on that. That's
thank you. It's cool. It's been a few years and I feel like we're kind of getting our feet under ourselves finally. We're going V1 on a project later this year, which I'll talk more about. But yeah, so, and I, again, you try to distract. Let me distract some more because there were many important announcements at Ignite. Like I would argue with the whole conversation around what a server 2016 is insanely important. It's one of the biggest versions of server they've made in a long time.
I would agree. Yeah. I was thrilled to hear some of the news around Azure Stack and what's going on there. Yeah. And I think they got the TP2 out the door for Azure Stack. And that was pretty impressive and very cool. And I'm excited to see what's going to come of that, because I think that's going to extend their capabilities to provide services way past what maybe some of their competitors are doing today.
And but also, you know, as an IT guy and as really an infrastructure architect, cloud is as much an architecture as it is a product. And so the fact that I'm getting more options to be able to buy cloud the way I want to buy it, the way my customers want to consume it, the way my organization values it. You know, I look at Azure Stack that way, you know, that I'm going to get that architecture, that operational mindset, but on premise or with a third party provider of my choice rather than the public cloud.
Well, I think one of the things that's fascinating around maybe cloud from a public cloud basis is that one of the reasons I think Microsoft has such a strong position, I mean, they're definitely in the solid number two slot without any question.
Yes.
I think the interesting part is they own the identity side from Office 365.
Yes.
And I think that's really a missing part for Amazon. I mean, and, you know, Google clearly has some identity portions from Google Apps, Pedigree, and things of that nature, and the fact that we all have Google IDs. But I think really that's a huge strength that Microsoft stands on, of being able to tie and federate Azure Active Directory in with Office 365, in with, you know, Azure integrated components within their cloud platform. I think that's just a huge strength that is underestimated in terms of their capabilities to provide that. I think Amazon really needs to, you know, not that I'm talking about competitive, but I think they need to add something in there around the identity side to go gain that foothold. And I think that, you know, You look at everyone who's popular in the sort of social media category, and whether that's Twitter or whether that's Facebook, it's all about your identity side there. That's the value proposition, I think, that needs to happen for this next extension.
I think the broader strokes on that whole idea is that the infrastructure part of the public cloud is solved.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's evolving. You know, VMs are morphing into containers, but, you know, we've got that nailed. In the end, we didn't actually want VMs or containers. They were a path to a goal. And that goal are these platforms. They're identity security. They are data storage. They are, you know, a bunch of other roles within any piece of software that's actually the service we want to buy. I don't want to own hardware. You know, the infrastructure solved that. I don't want to own operating systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you start thinking in terms of platform. That's like, I don't care what OS it is. You do that.
Yeah, you're getting to the point where I just want to run a snippet of code to go do the thing that I want it to do. And I think that, you know, serverless is definitely next generation of PaaS, right?
Yes.
Around doing that. But, you know, I mean, Node.js has been doing that for ages, right?
So yeah. It's presented exactly that idea in a much more dev perspective.
Yeah.
From an operations perspective.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing it's an amazing time to be doing this, some of the stuff we're doing. I think it's pretty fortunate.
And our work opportunities are broadening, right? I mean, you're now looking at descriptive language, configuration as code for networking.
Yep. Yeah. That's the huge investment right now, is doing exactly that.
Yeah. you know, I'm talking to my customers about, hey, you know, your networking isn't switches and cables. It is this description file that that is then executed to actually define the network.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly right. I mean, I think that's what's sort of cool around, you know, ARM and what they're providing as resources for everyone. And I'm adding V6 in was just some additional components within a JSON file.
It's absolutely part of the equation, right? And isn't it interesting when you start thinking in terms of that cloud as architecture, the introduction of a new protocol, a new way to bind these different instances together, it becomes much more coherent, right? It almost is not that important. We're now able to, through this configuration mindset, say, these are the instances that need to speak to each other. This is the path that they speak on. Like the level of inherent security in a really what we're talking now is a whitelist mindset of communication than a blacklist set of mine. You know, you described it earlier. I used to go into my host files and just block a couple of IPs, blacklisting.
Right.
The idea now that within a given application infrastructure or organizational infrastructure, we're whitelisting. Nobody talks to anybody except the way we talk. And this is the conversations we're prepared to have. And let me know when people want to talk outside of channels and we'll deal with it there.
Well, and more importantly is when you decide you want to do that, that is just defined in a descriptor file.
Yes.
You know, it just gets validated once and then that's it. You don't ever have to worry about that
but
again.
It also is easily traceable. You can see how often people are talking on those paths. You can find paths that are no longer in use like that. The upside to this whitelist approach is just much more transparent visibility into how network communications are actually going on.
Right. And you can act autonomously. I think that's really important too, right? It only impacts you in terms of how your infrastructure works. You don't have to worry about someone. You don't have to worry about the broader internet as a general rule of thumb.
Yeah, you've got all it in. And I love Wireshark. But boy, oh boy, talk about instantly drinking from the fire hose the first time you try and fire up Wireshark and figure out what's going on, right? It's like, and here's the whole universe.
First thing you learn how to do is use filters.
Yeah. Suddenly the light is very bright.
Yeah.
And you can't see anything. So, I mean, I'm very excited that we're going down a path where we could get to a place where you use a tool like Wireshark against a configuration tool for your software-defined network. And it would say, you know, here's what's communicating how, here's what's not following your guidance. What doesn't match up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty amazing, especially from a testing perspective, because if you can define that within test suites, you can audit through everything and find anomalies really quickly. I think that's one of the, certainly been a dream for a long time to be able to say, oh, I've got a harness that tests everything that I could possibly have. And I've got everything described as code to be able to validate through all the iteration possibilities. That's something we've been, you know, that's been a goal. But, you know, for those of us that are all command line jockeys who are changing everything behind the scenes, you never could validate anything that way.
Right? So, I remember when network testing meant ping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's ping all it was.
Trace route with your two tools, right? I mean, that was like.
Trace route, NS lookup, ping. Like, that's all I got. Do the names resolve? Can you get there? You know, is it responding? Thanks for playing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. At best, you maybe got some additional latency information that sort of tell you, but you only got that in one direction anyway.
Yeah. And only for certain providers, right? Like, and those numbers have gone down, not up. I mean, I think it also speaks to, and just trying to close out this story around IPv6 is we are going to have to learn our way around tooling that same way for IPv6. Part of getting good at this is how do you validate your connectivity, in this new network realm?
Yeah, I think Microsoft did you a big favor. They didn't change any of the commands.
It's all the same tools. I just use that as well. In fact, even if you don't mean to use it, you will see it. I mean, the number of times I'm actually poking around in a network and go, oh, we're actually routing on IPv6 here because all that stuff's on by default.
Right.
And we're within the network, so no big deal. You know, you didn't have to do anything on the front end for that, but it's working.
Yeah, and all the commands. I mean, the PowerShell commands, the reality is in PowerShell, there's only two commands that are unique for V6.
Right.
Everything else is shared for V4 and V6. They're identical. So if you know networking in V4, to add on some sort of configuration work, it's pretty much identical. They're not really any different outside of the fact of just the format for the V6 address. So, you know, go tackle it. It's not that difficult.
Yep. And it's becoming sort of almost a moot point. It's happening everywhere. Your ISP knows what you're talking about when you ask now. Like you have these options and your cloud provider.
Yeah, it's all here. I mean, I was my super stoked about, you know, Ignite was really Azure announcing V6 support. And for me, that was
huge.
That was worth taking a few moments to write a blog article. Right. So, but I think that's there are a lot of exciting things that came out of Ignite, obviously. But for me personally, that was a big milestone, having that team get that across the finish line. And I'm excited for when Amazon announces it too, because I think that pretty much I can put to bed the conversation around is V6 around or not.
Yeah, the top three cloud providers will also ultimately support it. And most of the other peripheral, tertiary cloud providers too. Like it's all good.
Yep.
So where are we going to find you next? You didn't make it to it tonight. Where will you be?
I'll be attending some conferences, and I'm also going to be doing some work with the Interop folks. So I'll be at Interop, and I'm actually on some of their technical committee to help out with some of their courses and what they're doing and things of that nature. So I'm super excited about that. Hopefully I'll be, maybe Cisco Live, maybe, probably AWS reInvent, a handful of different shows. I attend a lot now from a partner perspective. And so I try and stay under the radar because, I've got partner meetings.
Yes. But
from a speaking basis, I think Interop will probably be my next big one.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Ed, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Richard. Thanks so much.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.